Lizza as she recovers and makes it back for the third group stage game onto the field for her team. So, folks, thank you. This is the People's Game. We'll be doing these regularly across the World Cup. You can find us at peoples_game.com on X, peoples.game on Instagram, and all over social media. Just the People's.
Thepeoplesgame.org.
Friday, June 12th, Iran and the United States say they're closer than ever to a deal to end the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran as the U.S. bombs Iranian drones over the Strait of Hormuz. Shake up in the United Kingdom's Labour Party as two defense ministers resign back to back. California lawmakers urge Governor Gavin Newsom to fund public transit in the state budget that's due next week. These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad. Iran says it's closer than ever to a deal with the Trump administration, while details are slim. So far, the deal includes a 60-day timeline to negotiate Iran's nuclear program. Iran had sought a $300 billion reconstruction fund. No word on whether that will be part of the deal to end the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran. The announcement comes after the U.S. and Iran ramped up attack this week near the Strait of Hormuz. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Ismail Araghchi spoke to Iranian state TV and says the deal has two phases. His comments translated by Al Jazeera.
So what I would say now is that in the negotiations that will lead to the end of the war, there are two phases. The first one, there is an MOU signed by Iran and America. And later on, negotiations for the second phase will start, and in the second phase, we will come to a final agreement. Now the topic of the nuclear issue has been postponed to a final agreement. And there are different reasons for this. I cannot discuss that. The demands were not acceptable. So there were issues on which we could agree. So we said in the first phase, we'll do this. And for the nuclear story, it'll take 60 days. That's what's anticipated. The second phase of the final agreement will be covering sanctions removals and the nuclear program and one or two other issues.
But just minutes ago, Reuters is reporting the United States shot down Iranian drones headed for the Strait of Hormuz. It's the latest military flare-up, even as the U.S. and Tehran cite progress in their peace talks. U.S. President Donald Trump today had warned earlier against firing more drones at ships attempting to transit the strait, saying to Iran, better get their act together and fast. KPFA's Scott Baba has more.
Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif said negotiators for the United States and Iran had reached a, quote, final agreed upon text, and that mediators were working with both sides on next steps. In a social media post, Sharif wrote, quote, peace has never been this close as it is now. Representatives for Washington and Tehran also said they're close to a deal to end the 3.5-month war in the Middle East. though officials on both sides said the terms have not been finalized. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said an agreement had, quote, never been closer, while President Donald Trump suggested a signing ceremony could take place as soon as this weekend. Trump has repeatedly said deals to resolve the conflict were imminent, though previous claims have not materialized. The proposed ceasefire agreement, which was outlined by officials from the United States, Iran, and mediator Pakistan, would include a ceasefire, the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, and an easing of U.S. restrictions on Iran. During an interview on Iranian state television, Araghchi summarized the deal, saying, "There is the issue of the Strait of Hormuz with its details, the removal of maritime restrictions, the next round of negotiations, and the subjects it will include, Iran's nuclear issue, sanctions relief, reconstructions in the framework of an economic reconstruction and development plan, whose mechanisms will be agreed upon during subsequent negotiations, and other matters that will arise." The Memorandum of Understanding would also include Iran reaffirming its pledge not to pursue nuclear weapons, with broader nuclear negotiations to follow in later talks. But Araghchi pushed back against previous comments by President Donald Trump that nuclear material would be removed from Iran or destroyed. "Our position has always been, and this has long been our policy, that if high-level enriched uranium material, particularly the 60% enriched material, is to be addressed, then from our perspective, the only acceptable method is its dilution or conversion inside Iran." Iranian officials said internal deliberations were still underway. They also said Iran wants additional provisions related to regional conflicts, including Israel's military actions in Lebanon. Araghchi said that if signed, the agreement would help to normalize relations between the United States and Iran. "The two sides will respect each other's sovereignty. I believe this is the first time that after 47 years, the United States has explicitly expressed respect for the sovereignty of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and mentions this and puts it in writing, and asks us in return to respect the sovereignty of the United States." U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance said any agreement would prioritize U.S. and allied concerns, and argued economic benefits would follow Iranian compliance. Israeli officials said they are not party to the negotiations. Despite diplomatic signals, fighting and regional instability have continued, including Israeli airstrikes in southern Lebanon and ongoing exchanges involving Iran-aligned forces. Analysts said the proposal appears to amount to an initial 60-day ceasefire designed to open the door for longer negotiations over sanctions relief and Iran's nuclear program, a process that could take months or longer. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
India is calling on the United States to stop strikes on shipping vessels in the Gulf of Oman near the Strait of Hormuz after the U.S. fired three attacks on Indian crude tankers this week, including one that killed three sailors on the Palau-flagged tanker Satellibo. 21 others were evacuated. The U.S. Military Central Command had accused the Satellibo of having violated the ongoing blockade by attempting to transport oil from Iran. The deaths are the first reported since the U.S. imposed a blockade on Iran, linked shipping on April 13th. U.S. forces have disabled eight ships and turned back more than 100 others. In India, family of the slain are calling for an investigation into the U.S. strikes on the vessel. Ashok Kumar is the grandfather of deceased seafarer Ashish Sharma, and Rami Charakasia is father of a deceased seafarer, Sivanand Charakasia.
"An inquiry should be conducted. Culprits should be severely punished. My heart is dead. That's all."
"He called me and asked me how I was. Now my son is dead."
More from Ishan Garg in New Delhi for Feature Story News.
Father of an Indian sailor who was on the MT Sotavalo says he wants the government to investigate the circumstances that led to the death of three Indian crew members. US Central Command confirmed on Wednesday that it carried out precision strikes on the vessel's engine room after the ship allegedly failed to follow US military's orders, while Washington's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz continues. Family of one of the dead sailors says the ship's captain's role must also be investigated, arguing that the ship should not have been sailing in risky waters in the first place. The Indian government says it has lodged a strong protest with the US and called for an end to hostilities in the Gulf region, but critics are accusing the government of taking a weak stance and not doing enough to protect Indians stuck in the war-torn region. Ishan Garg, New Delhi.
It's been exactly 1 week since the House passed its version of the War Powers Resolution. Now President Donald Trump pushing for an end while seeking billions more in military spending. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
They didn't want presidents to draw us into a war because Congress knew how hard it was to stop it once it starts.
That was military law expert Jeffrey Korn. He says the U.S. Constitution gives Congress, not the president, the authority to authorize the use of military force, except in limited circumstances involving short-term operations or an immediate threat. However, previous administrations have sought to test the limits of that authority, leading to the creation of the War Powers Resolution of 1973, a federal law intended to check a president's power to initiate war.
This all kind of culminates during the Vietnam War in a series of lower court decisions when service members challenged the legality of their orders to go fight in the war. They say Congress hasn't declared war. And the War Powers Resolution was an effort by Congress to say to future presidents and future Congresses that there has to be affirmative authorization to go to war, with one exception: an attack on the United States, its territories, or armed forces, creating a national emergency.
Korn notes that the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran was not launched in response to a direct attack on the United States, and argues that the government has relied on semantics as a form of passive justification for its involvement.
Did you notice they're calling them self-defense operations? So the administration is trying to characterize the ongoing conflict as within the president's inherent authority as a bulwark against this resolution. If the War Powers Resolution were being complied with, the war was in violation of that resolution on day one and day two.
Under the War Powers Resolution, even retaliatory or defensive military actions are subject to limits. The law restricts unauthorized military action to 60 days, unless Congress formally declares war. And in the case of the Iran war, that clock expired May 1st, a reality that prompted some Republicans to join Democrats in supporting the War Powers Resolution, aimed at ending hostilities in the Middle East. Professor Korn looks to history to understand how this conflict could ultimately come to an end.
Bill Clinton, back in 1998, I think, the air war against Serbia went beyond 60 days without any authorization. Barack Obama, the air campaign against Libya in 2011, went beyond 60 days without authorization. What legislature and other things, small deployments to Central America and other operations, they've gone to court. And the courts won't do it. To have standing, you've got to enact a law to stop the president, and then he has to ignore it. That's the point at which your action has been completely nullified. And there are some scholars and justices who say even that's not enough, because Congress always has its own remedy for presidential illegality. It's impeachment and removal.
Absent a mechanism to enforce the new resolution, the votes may be viewed by some as largely symbolic, President Trump characterizing them as meaningless. However, North Bay Congressman Jared Huffman disagrees.
Look, when you now have each branch of Congress saying this is not a lawful war, that there is a military authorization of force necessary from Congress for this to proceed, that does count for something. And if nothing else, the president is going to have to ask for that when he asks for more money for this war. You've got this strong bipartisan statement. And he's going to be asking for hundreds of millions of dollars more money because this thing is hundreds of billions, rather, because this thing is burning through $2 billion a day. There's no way he gets that without Congress actually authorizing this war. And I don't think we're going to do it.
Professor Korn agrees with the representative, saying the votes still move the needle by signaling congressional intent and giving Congress the opportunity to wield another one of its constitutional powers, the power of the purse.
It deprives the president of the argument that he's got implicit legislative support. He can't make that argument anymore. The next step would be to enact a law cutting off all funding. That's Congress's sledgehammer.
However, the Trump administration has already used two budget reconciliation packages to circumvent Democratic opposition and advance its agenda, and is currently considering a third measure to boost military spending. Still, Congressman Huffman believes that would not be a popular move, even among his Republican colleagues.
There's no way. There's no way they get a third reconciliation bill through, especially when the focus is going to be this war.
Despite bipartisan support, the War Powers Resolution still faces long odds. The House and the Senate must reconcile their competing versions, and any final measure would likely face a presidential veto, requiring overwhelming support from Congress to override it.
So we have this ridiculous, I think, equation where Congress can endorse a war by a bare majority, but to stop a war, it requires a supermajority to override a presidential veto. I think that's wrong.
For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
Despite support for a War Powers Resolution, Republicans in the House and the Senate are advancing a historic military budget with a House version that is $234 billion more than this year's unprecedented military budget. The 2027 NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, cleared the Senate Armed Services Committee 18-9 Thursday in a closed-door meeting. The House's version, the 2027 Defense Appropriations Bill, cleared the Appropriations Defense Subcommittee also during a closed-door markup. The House bill provides $1.072 trillion for the Pentagon and other military-related activities, $234 billion more than this year's enacted level. The Senate version would increase more than $1 billion for maritime unmanned systems, beef up development and mass production of small unmanned aerial systems. It calls for the creation to incorporate artificial intelligence and autonomous weapons in the military and folds the National Guard into the military's Arctic strategy, designating an Arctic National Guard. This as the military's looking to use artificial intelligence in warfare and as President Donald Trump has threatened to annex Greenland from Denmark and make Canada the 51st state of the U.S. Earlier this week, Senator Elizabeth Warren on the Senate Armed Services Committee criticized the military spending.
This markup comes at a time when President Trump and Secretary Hegseth are risking the life of service members in an illegal war with Iran while making life more difficult for troops and their families back home. It also comes at a time when the Trump administration continues to politicize the military to serve their own agenda.
Warren said she was disturbed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth intervened in military appointments, noting zero promotions were women in the last year. She said Hegseth removed the promotions of two women and a black man, blocked the appointment of 9 Air Force colonels, and delayed promotion of at least 24 senior Air Force officers, while the Pentagon reviews their, quote, ties to diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, unquote. GOP Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama hailed the military budget and its benefits for service members.
Support for military families through child care, spouse employment, education, and exceptional family member program improvements. It enhances TRICARE access, suicide prevention efforts, medical readiness, and combat health capabilities. Finally, it reinforces coordination between the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs to improve healthcare delivery, and long-term support for service members, veterans, and their families.
Warren suggested it fell short in providing benefits for all Pentagon workers in civil service.
It was shameful that this administration failed to include any pay raises for civilian employees in its budget request. This mark includes some funding for civilians through bonuses, but at a time when President Trump's policies drive up costs for all Americans, it is unfair and insulting to deny DOD civilians a pay raise.
Robert Weissman, co-president of the consumer advocacy watchdog Public Citizen, said in a statement, there's growing bipartisan opposition to wartime funding, noting that dozens of lawmakers shot down more spending during committee sessions, and the bipartisan majority of the House voted for an Iran War Powers Resolution directing President Trump to end the war. But he said Trump's military request is closer to $1.5 trillion. And quote, Trump has repeatedly stated he doesn't care about child care, inflation, or addressing the needs of the American people. Instead, he's seeking an overall $600 billion annual increase in Pentagon spending that would raise the total Pentagon budget to over $1.5 trillion. The money that Trump wants to burn on war should instead be spent on the needs of the American people, including restoring funding for health care, food, housing, and climate action. Unquote. The House Veterans Affairs Technology Modernization Subcommittee today held a field hearing in Grand Ledge, Michigan, on improving veterans' health care for members and vets around the nation. KPFA's Max Pringle reports.
Michigan Republican Tom Barrett chairs the Technology and Modernization Subcommittee. He said he's heard from vets in his district that getting a convenient appointment at a VA hospital or clinic near them is the most aggravating part of dealing with the VA. He added that as an Army veteran himself, he's dealt with it.
VA must continue to strengthen its community care program to ensure that the doctors and providers living in our communities can continue to meet veterans where they live and work. Every decision VA makes should focus on putting veterans first, not bureaucracy.
Democratic ranking member Nikki Baczynski from Illinois said a main cause for the delays in veterans' abilities to book appointments is the slow appointment scheduling process.
Veterans wait for a scheduler to call them. Then they wait while the scheduler calls around to different providers looking for an available slot. The whole process takes far too many phone calls and, quite frankly, far too much time. It delays veterans' care, and it needs to be fixed.
Baczynski said the External Provider Scheduling Program, or EPS, is the fix that the system needs. It basically allows VA schedulers to enter an appointment into a provider's scheduling system over the computer. Baczynski said the system still has holes, however, and the Trump administration's VA has been slow to fix them.
While they may have successfully deployed the technology, the network of community care providers sharing their scheduling grids continues to be insufficient in the number and diversity of specialties to make it a meaningful tool. There are well over 1 million community providers, and VA has only signed up about 25,000. That's barely 2%. Additionally, we recently learned that of the providers that have signed up, they have a greater than 30% turnover rate, meaning they're losing providers while almost as fast as they're signing them up.
The members of the committee said they would take what they learned during their trip to Michigan back to their work in Washington on the full Veterans Affairs Committee. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
The Trump administration announced sanctions against Cuba's state-owned oil and gas company in a move expected to further increase tensions between the two countries. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Thursday key assets of the company, known as SUPET, were unlawfully expropriated from American owners years ago. He also accused Cuba's government of weaponizing energy. A U.S. blockade of oil to Cuba has led to rolling blackouts and put lives at risk as hospitals and other facilities across the island nation struggle to keep the power on. Cuba's Foreign Affairs Minister Bruno Rodriguez said on social media, quote, the U.S. Secretary of State, driven by the vindictive sentiments of the elitist clique that propelled his political career, now further tightening the blockade. To justify this, he doesn't resort to excuses prepared by a State Department, but rather to the usual vulgar lies. President Donald Trump has said Cuba is next after Iran. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told reporters in Tampa Wednesday the military has various options for Cuba's president if Trump greenlights military intervention. He spoke to a reporter.
How long would it take to, you know, reestablish order if President Trump were to decide to do a capture or kill operation with Miguel Diaz-Canel like he did with Maduro in Venezuela?
All I would say is options, options, options. Our job is to present options at different scales, depending on where the commander-in-chief and the president of the United States wants to go.
So capture and kill is still an option?
We've got options all over the map. The president expects us to be strong and resolute with the way that we respond and bring firepower, and we will certainly do that if need be.
Meanwhile, a ship carrying nearly 100 tons of food and basic humanitarian necessities arrived in Havana from Colombia today amid the severe U.S. energy blockade. Flying the Colombian flag, the ship departed from Cartagena de Indias earlier this month and sailed through the channel of the capital's bay today, escorted by a small Cuban auxiliary vessel. Colombia's Presidential Agency for International Cooperation stated that President Gustavo Petro's direction, a shipment of non-perishable food, medicines, hospital supplies, electrical equipment, solar panels, and other items had been sent. In addition to the supplies, 7 tons of goods collected by groups supporting the island in the South American country were loaded onto the ship, according to authorities. Ukrainian forces have targeted fuel supplies to the Crimean Peninsula overnight. That has triggered the worst fuel crisis on the Black Sea Peninsula since it was illegally annexed by Russia in 2014. The persistent attacks reflect Ukraine's growing ability to carry out drone strikes that have caught Russia off guard, struggling for a response. The gas shortages are threatening to cause further disruptions to the tourism-dependent region, with its beaches and resorts, just as summer holiday season is getting underway. Ukraine's successes have highlighted its ability to inflict damage on Russia and potentially change the course of the war. The Trump administration has quietly instructed federal prosecutors in Miami to avoid pursuing criminal investigations into Venezuela's acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, a longtime target of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. She once directed state oil profits to contribute to Trump's last presidential campaign. It's a latest sign of warming relations between the White House and the oil-rich nation. With Rodriguez at the helm, it's unclear whether prosecutors had implicated Rodriguez in any crimes or whether investigators were moving toward an indictment. A Justice Department spokesperson said in an email, there was never an investigation into her to shut down. The man charged in the political assassination of a Democratic Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband has pled guilty to the killing in federal court. The plea comes after prosecutors say they would not seek the death penalty. Vance Bolter was charged with the murder and the deaths of Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark Hortman. He's also charged in the non-fatal shootings of State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, Yvette Hoffman. Those two sat in the courtroom galley Thursday along with members of the Hortman family as the events of the night were described in great detail. Bolter repeatedly said a simple yes as his federal defense attorney questioned him about his actions, including whether he pressed a gun to Democrat Melissa Hortman's head and pulled the trigger. Bolter went into their doors in the early hours of June of last year, disguised as a policeman and driving a fake squad car. United States Attorney David Rosen.
Political violence is a scourge plaguing America in our times. The murders of Speaker of the House Melissa Hortman and Mark Hortman, shooting of Senator John Hoffman and Yvette Hoffman, and the attempted shooting of Hope Hoffman are among the worst political violence crimes that we have seen. Today, the United States achieved the admissions and the agreement necessary for the perpetrator of those crimes to spend the rest of his life in prison without possibility of release. Those that would commit political violence at any level should take heed that the Department of Justice will seek and obtain the longest prison terms available for your crimes.
Bolter also faces state charges, which have been on hold pending the resolution of his federal case. You are listening to the Pacifica Evening News from KPFA 94.1 FM, 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. It's an hour-long newscast that airs each night at 6 o'clock with half-hour editions on the weekends. All our newscasts are archived online and are available as podcasts.
This is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Shanti.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and live around the world at
the United Kingdom's Defense Minister, Al Carnes, resigned from his position today. Carnes followed UK Defense Secretary John Healey, who also unexpectedly quit just a day earlier, Thursday, saying the government is unwilling to spend enough money on the military at a time of rising threats. Moments before resigning today, Carnes gave an interview to Sky News while still holding his position in the defense ministry. He did not confirm whether the prime minister's office had approved his appearance or not. During the interview, Carnes expressed dissatisfaction with the defense investment plan laid out by the government, and he emphasized the importance of the UK's need for a strong defense budget. He also hinted if the final approved plan was not satisfactory from his perspective, he would consider resigning. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer has pledged to boost defense spending in the United Kingdom to 2.5% of gross domestic product by 2027, then 3% by 2035. But some in the military say that isn't enough. British Defense Secretary John Healey resigned Thursday, saying the government unwilling to spend the amount of money that's needed on the military at the time of rising threats. A federal judge extended her freeze on the Trump administration's $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund today, saying Justice Department assurances the plan is dead, carry little weight without sworn declarations. District Judge Leonie Brinkema had originally issued an order 2 weeks ago, putting a temporary hold on setting up the fund or making any payments from it. The freeze was set to expire today. During a hearing on the matter, Brinkema said statements from Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche and President Donald Trump himself created serious doubt the program had truly been abandoned. Trump had said he doesn't know whether the fund has been eliminated, and in a recent interview with NBC after it had been put on hold, still said he thought it was a good idea. Brinkema also pressed DOJ Attorney Andrew Block on whether he could could explain why Blanche had not issued something in writing to rescind his May 18th order detailing procedures for the fund if the plan were truly dead. Brinkema gave the government 1 week to submit declarations under penalty of perjury from Blanche and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, confirming the fund is finished. She said she would likely dismiss the case if they comply. The fund was designated to compensate people who claim they were targeted by politically motivated federal investigations and prosecutions under previous administrations, notably January 6 defendants who stormed the Capitol in support of Trump's claim, false claim, the election was stolen from him. The Israeli publication Haaretz is reporting one of the closest aides to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Yonatan Uric, was indicted Thursday for espionage. He allegedly leaked classified documents to a German publication Bild about one of two investigations into criminal conduct within the Prime Minister's office, known as the Bibi Leaks affair. The classified document was falsely presented as indicating Hamas was uninterested in an agreement to release hostages. Uric was indicted on 5 counts, including 2 for endangering state security, a serious espionage-related offense that could carry a life sentence. Other charges include destroying evidence. Netanyahu faced calls for his resignation over failing to obtain the release of hostages held by Hamas after armed members of the group orchestrated a massacre in southern Lebanon that sparked the war in Gaza nearly 3 years ago. Netanyahu had said Hamas unwilling to release the hostages, but the new indictment questions that narrative. After passing on the classified document, Ulrich wrote to a colleague, "The boss is pleased." The state prosecutor's office has also requested Ulrich be barred from working within Netanyahu's office. Netanyahu also the subject of a corruption trial. Other high-profile ministers in his party, the Likud party, are also the subject of corruption investigations. Wednesday, Israeli police referred Social Equality Minister May Golan to stand trial for creating fake jobs, offenses that include bribery, fraud, breach of trust, forgery, obstruction of justice, and obstruction of a law enforcement officer in the performance of their duties. Israeli authorities have deported a French journalist, Alice Frossard, after refusing her entry at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport. They cited her reporting critical of Israel's war in Gaza. The Foreign Press Association called the allegations against her outrageous. Press freedom groups have condemned Israel for its actions against journalists since the Gaza war. The Trump administration had proposed 25% tariffs on imports from Brazil, charging the world's 10th biggest economy engages in trade practices that are unreasonable and that burden or restrict U.S. commerce. The announcement came after an investigation by the Office of Trade Representative that charged Brazil with lax anti-corruption enforcement and unfair tariffs of its own, among other things. The U.S. has had good trade surplus with Brazil for years. Its president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, said he received the decision with indignation, and he blamed the U.S. administration on his rival in October's election, Senator Flavio Bolsonaro, who visited Washington before the decision was made. The senator is the son of former President Jair Bolsonaro, once nicknamed the Trump of the tropics by his allies, who was found guilty of trying to overturn his election loss in Brazil and in a plot to assassinate Lula da Silva. Opposition is already mounting to the prospects of a Republican governor in California, as Steve Hilton has advanced to the November ballot. He will vie against Democrat Javier Becerra to lead the state over the next 4 years. Becerra, a former state attorney general and Health and Human Services secretary for the Obama administration. Reproductive Freedom for All said in a statement, November's general election will determine whether California continues to protect abortion patients and providers or elects a Trump-endorsed extremist who would leave them exposed to attacks from anti-abortion states. The group notes Hilton previously stated he would allow anti-abortion states to pursue California doctors that provide abortion care legal in California. In the final state gubernatorial debate, Hilton doubled down that position, raising the group's concerns California's next governor could stop defending patients and providers from politically motivated attacks from out-of-state prosecutors, the group said. After the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the landmark ruling Roe v. Wade that legalized abortion, 13 states passed near full abortion bans, taking away a woman's right to choose whether or not to carry a pregnancy. Despite lobbying on the issue, it didn't sway voters enough. Trump, who appointed three of the Supreme Court justices, won a return to the White House, the main issue for voters appearing to be the economy. If Hilton rails against California's high cost of living and taxes, he too may have a shot of electoral victory. But since California hasn't voted in a Republican governor in 15 years, and has more recently had a supermajority of Democrats in the state legislature, that could be a long shot. Becetta so far has 29% of the vote, Hilton at around 25. But if one extrapolates the other votes for Democrats in the June 2nd primary, giving that to Becetta, he could win by a wide margin. Reproductive Freedom for All President and CEO Mini Timuraju released a statement warning of a Hilton governorship, writing Hilton is part of a national anti-abortion agenda aimed at pushing care out of reach everywhere, even in states like California where abortion is protected. California needs a leader who will hold the line against coordinated national efforts to roll back reproductive freedom, not help advance them, unquote. Meanwhile, Becetta is getting support from healthcare for all groups despite reluctance to come out for a Medicare for all payer system during debates that progressives had pushed for. Becetta was more nuanced in his support during the debates, stating everyone should have a right to healthcare. The Medicare for all advocacy group Protect Our Care said about Becetta in a statement, as a 12-term member of Congress and later California Attorney General, he not only championed the passing of the Affordable Care Act, but he also defended it in court against repeated GOP attacks. As HHS Secretary under President Biden, he oversaw the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act, implementing groundbreaking drug price negotiations that helped millions of working families save money on life-saving medications. He also helped secure enhanced premium tax credits, which enabled millions of Americans to afford coverage. And in Congress, as a member of both Democratic congressional leadership and the House Ways and Means Committee, Becetta championed, shaped, and wrote key portions of the Affordable Care Act. Correction, the story earlier said Becetta worked under the Obama administration as Health and Human Services. That was the Biden administration. California's Democratic leaders in the state Senate and Assembly have hammered out a $356 billion budget plan. It's at odds with Governor Gavin Newsom in several key areas. Newsom proposed increasing the health care premium payment for undocumented immigrants on Medi-Cal from $30 to $50 a month. The lawmakers' plan would defer that decision until next year. They also delay Newsom's plan to eliminate certain dental benefits for Medi-Cal recipients. That's a state health care program for low-income individuals and families. The Democrats call for $80 million more than the governor proposed for immigrant legal aid, $70 million more for local food banks, and reject Newsom cuts to the in-home support services program. Lawmakers have a June 15th deadline for passing a budget. After that, Democratic leaders will hold intensive talks with Newsom on a final compromise plan. Earlier this week, transit and housing advocates denounced Newsom's plan to cut funding for public transit and certain low-income housing programs. KPFA's Eileen Alfandari reports.
Public transit is on the chopping block again this budget year. San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener said Governor Gavin Newsom's administration needs to prioritize public transit and stop treating it as an afterthought.
I'm going to be honest. I'm a little pissed off that we have to be here again this year, because it feels like we have to do this every year. Every year, transit funding becomes a political football in the budget. Every year, the administration proposes cuts. Every year, we have to have just lots of back and forth and uncertainty and drama. And then we do what we need to do to make sure that public transportation is not cut.
This year, there's a double whammy. Governor Newsom's budget plan failed to include $690 million in public transit funding that had been promised in a deal 3 years ago. And the California Air Resources Board voted to reallocate $600 million a year in spending away from transit and certain low-income housing programs. Former Sacramento City Councilmember Katie Valenzuela, a consultant to Communities for a Better Environment, addressed her remarks to Newsom.
A deal is a deal. This administration made a deal with us last year. They made a deal that they were not going to leave behind disadvantaged communities. They made a deal that they were going to keep funding transit and affordable housing. They made a deal that we were actually going to see clean water in communities that have been waiting over decades for that promise to be realized. Governor Newsom, you made a deal. You made a deal with all of us. You made a deal with all of our communities. We need you to make real on that promise.
According to a two-year-old study, Los Angeles commuters already lose an average of 89 hours a year stuck in rush hour traffic. Assemblymember Mark Gonzalez, who represents downtown L.A., said if public transit deteriorates, many transit users will have no choice but to buy a car or be unable to go to school, shop, or doctor's appointments.
And public transit is the way for many of us and so many other Californians who are able to get to work. It's how abuelitas are able to get their groceries home, how many people are able to get to churches, how this last election, how many people were able to vote. In my district, most households have either no or just one vehicle available to them on their daily use. Public transportation is the bridge, an equitable and accessible option for so many.
In a letter last week to lawmakers, environmental groups took aim at the recent vote by the California Air Resources Board stripping funding from transit, housing, and clean water programs. The groups called the decision a, quote, $4 billion subsidy for oil companies and other big polluters. It urged lawmakers to do what they can to reverse the decision. Meantime, voters in Alameda, Santa Clara, Contra Costa, and San Mateo counties will face a half-cent sales tax on the November ballot to fund public transportation. San Francisco voters will be asked to approve a one-cent sales tax. I'm Eileen Alfandary for KPFA News.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins testified before the Senate Agriculture Committee this week about her oversight of the agency, fielding questions about costs of the Iran war and President Trump's tariffs have added to the nation's farmers. KPFA's Max Pringle reports.
In her opening remarks, Secretary Rollins touted the administration's agricultural policies as a success for the country.
Last year, President Trump and congressional Republicans delivered the Working Families Tax Cut Act, a historic piece of legislation and a victory for U.S. agriculture, which increased reference prices for the first time in more than a decade and saved 2 million family farms from the death tax, among so many other wins.
The hearing comes as the screw worm has reemerged. It's a parasitic fly that had been thought eliminated in the U.S. in the 1960s. Rollins blamed Biden-era immigration policies for its return. Ranking Democrat on the committee, Minnesota's Amy Klobuchar, questioned the president's decision to go to war with Iran, which she said has led to fuel prices and fertilizer prices skyrocketing, particularly for farmers.
The skyrocketing cost of fertilizer is threatening their operations. As we all know, nearly half of the global urea and 30% of global ammonia exports used in nitrogen fertilizer supply chains move through the Straits of Hormuz. Earlier this spring, the Farm Bureau highlighted the financial strain farmers are experiencing, estimating that 70% of farmers couldn't afford all the fertilizer they needed. Of the farmers they surveyed, 94% said their financial situation has worsened or flatlined
Rollins said the administration is providing assistance to struggling farmers.
As we expand opportunity over the long term, we are also providing farmers with our short-term support today through the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program, the Assistance for Specialty Crop Farmers Program, and others. USDA has delivered tens of billions of dollars in targeted direct relief to help our farmers manage natural disasters and temporary market disruptions.
Georgia Democrat Raphael Warnock asked Rollins about the costs that President Trump's tariff policies have added to working families.
The 3% is actually an average cost of food increase over the years. Under the last administration, went up 20%. But the SNAP, I think, is really
important. Do you realize, Madam Secretary, with all due respect, how sterile that answer sounds
for
the person who's trying? You say, well, you know, that's the mean cost. But right now, somebody's trying to buy groceries in Georgia, and they can't afford it.
Well, but that's because of the Biden administration is the reason.
2 years later, that's your answer? Because of the Biden administration?
Look at this. Look at all the prices that have come down.
The affordability crisis has dogged the administration as the November midterm elections approach. Democrats on the panel said President Trump's tariff policies have been reckless and that his war with Iran has unnecessarily disrupted fuel and fertilizer costs for millions worldwide. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
A new AP NRRC poll finds as the U.S. prepares to celebrate 250 years of independence next month, fewer Americans are as confident about the health of the country's democracy. The findings highlight many Americans' feeling of unease over the future of its representative government, particularly amongst younger people. Only about one quarter of Americans say the U.S. stands above all other countries in the world, and Americans are less likely to see a democratic elected government as extremely or very important to the United States identity as a nation than they were just a few years ago. The NAACP has launched a boycott of southern states amid a redistricting battle that for many harkens back to the Jim Crow South, disenfranchising black voters. Daria Miranova with Pacifica Radio affiliate WMMNF in Tampa, Florida, reports.
The NAACP is urging black athletes, recruits, fans, and donors to reconsider supporting major public universities in the South until lawmakers restore fair congressional maps and black representation. The Out of Bounds campaign asks top football and basketball recruits to delay or withhold commitments to schools in those states. Yvette Lewis, president of the Hillsborough County NAACP, says the goal is to create pressure.
What it is an economic boycott. It will be suppressing the millions of dollars that we pour into these schools.
But some experts question the strategy. Dr. Jeffrey O'Brien, CEO of the Institute for Sport and Social Justice, says athletes shouldn't be the only ones expected to take action.
You're talking about student athletes who, in some cases, may come from a situation where their family doesn't have a lot of money. And now you're telling them that they shouldn't take the money, you know, because of a principled stance.
For now, the NAACP hopes athletes, families, and fans will use their influence to pressure lawmakers and universities. For WMNF News, I'm Daria Miranova.
Independent Vermont Senator Progressive Bernie Sanders met with OpenAI CEO Sam Altman recently. The reported one-hour private meeting was to discuss the future of artificial intelligence and Sanders' call for an equity fund that would give the public 50% ownership of the most powerful AI companies in the U.S. Altman reportedly told Sanders he also wants the public to have an equity in AI companies, but could not back a 50% threshold Sanders is proposing. As KPFA News reported last week, President Donald Trump has also floated a kind of benefit for the public from AI. Meanwhile, AI company Anthropic has joined calls for the AI industry to find ways to cushion people from AI's disruptions to the workforce. The company announced a $200 million investment to research AI's economic impact. CEO Dario Amodei published an essay Wednesday with proposals for government support for those financially affected by artificial intelligence. He warned AI could cause significant and lasting labor market disruptions and suggested data collection, pro-employment policies, and possibly universal basic income. Wind Kaufman was found guilty this week of misdemeanors linked to a 2025 protest in front of OpenAI's offices in San Francisco. The engineering professor and lead organizer of the anti-AI group Stop AI led a protest blocking entrances to the OpenAI offices, preventing employees from entering the building. In court, Kaufman presented a necessity defense, asserting her actions were justified as a response to the immediate AI threat. In response to CEO Sam Altman's comments of the dangers of artificial intelligence and growing fears of how AI could reshape society. Animal rights activists rallied today outside the West Coast headquarters of pharmaceutical giant Merck, demanding the company release dozens of beagles purchased from a Wisconsin breeding factory facing criminal animal cruelty allegations. KPFA's Scott Baba reports.
Members of Direct Action Everywhere, a grassroots animal rights network, were in South San Francisco protesting animal experimentation by biopharmaceutical company Merck. The group alleges that one of Merck's New York labs recently acquired 54 beagles from the controversial dog breeder Ridgeland Farms for laboratory testing and research. Kathy King is an organizer with Direct Action Everywhere. She said the group is calling on the company to rethink its acquisition and use of dogs for experimentation.
Merck continued to buy dogs for experimentation from Ridgeland Farms, even as other smaller customers have cut ties and said, now that we see the horrible conditions and the cruelty these animals are enduring, including surgeries without anesthesia at Ridgeland Farms, we're cutting ties. We're dropping this supplier. So we're holding a protest today to ask Merck to do the same thing, to cut ties with Ridgeland Farms, and to hopefully release the beagles that they purchased back in April from Ridgeland Farms to rescue organizations.
Ridgeland Farms has drawn national attention in recent months. Last year, a Wisconsin judge found probable cause of felony animal cruelty and appointed a prosecutor to investigate. The facility later agreed to close its breeding operations by July 1st as part of an agreement that avoided criminal charges. King said the company still has more than 600 dogs in its possession and that their fate remains uncertain. However, she was optimistic that developments at Ridgeland reflect growing opposition to animal experimentation.
Ridgeland is the second largest breeder of beagles for experimentation in the U.S. and they are on the verge of collapse right now. And the other of the three largest, Envigo, shuttered in 2022 following PETA investigations and pressure from a number of different groups. And so that really only leaves Marshall Bio Resources as the last major breeder of beagles for experimentation, of dogs for experimentation in the country. The tide is really turning, and I think Marshall's going to be facing a lot of public pressure after this.
Merck reported $65 billion in revenue in 2025, making it one of the world's largest biomedical companies. King said the company has both the resources and the influence to transition away from animal testing methods.
We would like to see Merck do the right thing in this situation and release these dogs who have already suffered so much at Ridgeland Farms and let them recover in rescues. And beyond that, we, of course, want to see Merck and other leaders in this industry transition to modern science that does not rely on outdated, cruel, and inefficient animal testing methods.
Merck could not be reached for comment. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
Shares of SpaceX soared 19% in their Wall Street debut today, making the rocket maker's founder and CEO Elon Musk the first ever trillionaire. The shares opened at $150. They finished slightly below $161. The price giving the company a market value of about $2.1 trillion. A federal appeals court today refused to block an order requiring President Donald Trump's name be removed from the Kennedy Center, leaving in place a court-imposed deadline for the arts institution to reverse its rebranding by the end of the day. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit denied an emergency request from the Kennedy Center after District Judge Christopher Cooper had rejected a similar appeal earlier in the day. Cooper ruled last month only Congress, not the...
DJ Namde from Radio Aphrodisia. Join us every Saturday as we nice up your weekend. It's all about music from Africa and the African world. Radio Aphrodisia, 4 to 6 p.m. It's Champeta Criolla from the coast of Caribbean, Soca Calypso, Juju Music, Musica Afro-Cubana, Juju Music, Musica Afro-Cubana, Cha-Cha-Cha.